Thank you very much, Brad, and for a very kind introduction. And I'd like to thank ARSC for inviting me to speak about this work here today. Maybe you want to bring the room lights down a little bit so people... Is that better? Okay, good. So as the talk is entitled, I'm going to talk about some new imaging methods that we've been studying and applying to both preservation and access issues related to mechanical sound carriers. Okay, so Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is where I work. There's a website you can visit if you want to know more about the facility, but it's a large federally funded research center, the oldest national laboratory in the United States. It was founded by Ernest Lawrence, who you can see in this picture, who invented the cyclotron. That was the first one. It's about the size of a CD, but there are examples of these things now that are miles and miles in circumference, which CDs will never will never get to. They won't be compact, right? They'll be colossal. Anyway, lots of different research goes on there, and it's got a million-dollar view of the San Francisco Bay. So please come and visit sometime. So as I said, we're developing some methods of optically recovering mechanical recordings without contact to the medium. And so what we're hoping to do is to address a number of concerns that your community has. Preservation. Reconstruction of delicate or damaged media without any further degradation, and access, developing strategies that will facilitate massive digitization of diverse media. And the approach that we're using, I mean, it came out of methods that we were applying to other problems, but it really falls comfortably in the world of optical metrology, pattern recognition, image processing, which are widely studied both academically and commercially and in broad use across the world. So the basic idea of non-contact digital imaging in this case is to create a high-resolution digital map of the entire surface of a sound carrier. So in its ultimate form, it would be like a topographic map that you might have of the mountains in Colorado or something like that, or Washington. Then you, with this map, which is in digital form, so it's on a computer, the computer can now play the record virtually by essentially calculating what a stylus would do if it was going to move through that surface. Obviously, this protects these samples from any further damage because you're not actually touching them. It also opens up the possibility that you could repair some of the existing damage through the same kind of touch-up strategies that you might use to fix a photograph which maybe has a hair scratch or something like that. And sort of in its ultimate form, what you could imagine doing is offloading many of the aspects of restoration and the process that people have to go through when they do transcriptions to kind of expert software that makes the decisions about how big the stylus should be, the virtual stylus should be, you know, by looking at the image and calculating things sort of by algorithms. So you can think of it almost eventually as like a smart copying machine for records. So here's some numbers to kind of set the scale of the problem. I mean, I don't have to introduce the media to you. I give this talk to all different sorts of audiences, and I've dropped a lot of stuff that I think is very commonly known, obviously, in your community. But I'll just focus on these two sort of basic formats. The cylinder. As you know, the sound is encoded in the vertical modulation of the surface. And if you actually measure what the surface looks like, it's like a little cut along the axis of the cylinder showing a handful of tracks. And from ridge to ridge, it's sort of 120 to 250 microns. And the depth of the valley is really only sort of 10 or 15 microns. And all the sound information is sort of stored in that very, very small modulation. And 25 microns is like a fine human hair. So it's a very, very small physical region in which the sound is encoded. In the case of the lateral disc, here's a cut across there. As you know, of course, the sound is now encoded in the side-to-side movement of the groove. The groove is roughly constant in depth and maybe is 75 or 80 microns deep. The sound is stored in a quite a bit larger physical movement of the groove than in the case of the cylinder. So This is an image which I'll explain in more detail later, but is a tiny sort of 1 by 1 millimeter view of what the topographic representation of the cylinder surface would look like, and you can see the stylus would ride in that valley. In the case of the lateral groove, this is instead a microphotograph taken under certain conditions that I'll also explain, where you can very clearly see the lateral side-to-side modulation of the groove, a characteristic of a disc. Let's see. I kind of made a little table of these numbers. So I kind of compare the 78 RPM 10-inch shellac disc with the wax or plastic cylinder, obviously the lateral and the vertical cuts. The total area containing audio data, say in a 78, is about almost 40,000 square centimeters, but the sound is encoded in movements of the groove wall, which is on the scale of microns. So if you want to treat this as a measurement problem, you have to measure at the kind of micron or submicron scale over tens of thousands of square millimeters. So there's a huge disparity sort of in scale between what you, the thing you need to measure and the amount of stuff that you actually need to survey. So I come back to that picture. Here's your disc, and here's a microphotograph of a shellac disc. Now in this image, the white surfaces are anything that's flat. So this is sort of the surface of the record, and the little white line here is the bottom of the groove. And anything that's black is not flat, so that's the groove wall or scratches on the surface. And pretty much a microphotograph of this sort can capture most of the audio information which is present on a lateral recording and is probably sufficient to capture that information. Instead, if you're in a vertical modulation, you know a photograph is not a good way of measuring distance or height, and so you actually need a full surface profile, and I'll discuss in a moment how to go about getting that. So the basic method, as I've said, I'm just going to repeat, is to somehow digitally image the surface. That might be in two dimensions, it might be as a three-dimensional surface profile. Cover the surface with sort of a sequence of views or grids of these measurements to create a full map. Stitch them together and achieve that the full coverage that you require. And then process that image optionally to remove some of the defects that might be present. And then analyze that map in order to create this model of how a stylus would move through it. Then sample that model at some standard frequency and create a digital sound file from that physical model. And so this is a method, if you like, of moving these objects into the digital realm. We never thought of it as a player, which it would have to run in real time. So it's a process. It's not an attempt to build like a laser turntable, which is an object that many of you may already be familiar with. So we never considered real-time playback as be a necessary requirement of this effort. So to do that imaging, which we just talked about, in the case of the electronic camera, that you can apply to the lateral groove. Here's another version of that picture you saw, and here's a kind of cross section of the groove. So that this would correspond to this thing. And the light that we use when we illuminate these things is not like the light that we normally think of when we do photographs, which is going in every direction. We illuminate it with light that is perpendicular to the surface. That's called coaxial illumination. And so only things that are flat reflect back up into our optics. And anything else, the light scatters off in some other direction. And that's why we get these very high contrast images where the groove walls that are sloping appear black, as do scratches and dust particles and things like that. Whereas the surface, or most of the surface, and the groove bottom, which is quite flat, both appear white. Is that clear? If you then blow one of these things up, this is showing you the actual bottom of the groove, and you can see a nice little dust particle or something that happens to be sitting there. It might have originated in a click that somebody once heard. So. The scale of resolution that you need if you want to take meaningful images in this way is that about 1 micron on the surface of one of these recordings has to map to about one of the little pixel elements in the digital cameras that we're using. Now, if you want to measure 3D, as I told you, taking a picture of the room, I don't get a very good idea of the distances between people or anything. So you have to go to another physical mechanism. And there's a phenomenon which is usually considered to be a bad thing, which is called chromatic aberration. And the idea of chromatic aberration is that different colors of light will be bent differently by a medium. And so what this is showing is a lens, and because of its index of refraction, the blue, green, and red light come into focus at slightly different places. When you buy a camera, you don't want to have chromatic aberration because it will create these sort of colorful halos that aren't really supposed to be there. However, this bad effect can be turned into a virtue in some cases and used as a measurement tool. And there's actually a device which is called a chromatic confocal scanning probe that uses chromatic aberration as a method of measuring distance. And it's very simple the way it works. It starts off with a white light source, and that light source, it goes through a pinhole, so it's a very small spot. And it gets focused by a lens that has a large chromatic aberration. And so the light of different colors comes into focus at different places. That light then reflects off the surface, goes through a splitter, and through another pinhole. And whatever color comes back in focus can be correlated with where the surface was. So by looking at which colors come back as you move a surface through the region of measurement of this device, you can infer what the surface structure is. It's a commercial device. You can buy one if you want to forego a BMW or something like that. But which isn't that much money, I guess, these days. Or even if you want to buy gas for it. Anyway, this image that I've been showing you in a couple of pictures was actually acquired with such a probe. Okay. And so it's actually a very good tool in terms of its accuracy and its stability and its robustness for doing the kind of measurements that you would want to do to get the audio information off a vertically modulated media. So how long does it take to actually make these measurements? Well, it really depends on what you want to do. If you want to use microphotography and essentially get the two-dimensional information that I advertised off disks, then you can use very fast cameras that are commercially available. And what we found is that you can basically scan the entire surface of a disk with two-dimensional information only in sort of 5 to 15 minutes of data taking, which is just a few times, you know, the 3 or 4 minutes of audio that might be on that surface. So that's a pretty fast method. And if you could build a machine that would basically run under those principles, you could think of that as an effective tool with potential for access kind of transcriptions, at least, right? Because it gives you the sort of massive measurement capability that you want. If you want to scan the vertical media using the confocal methodology that I described, unfortunately, at the state of today's technology, it's not fast at all. In fact, it's painfully slow compared to what you might consider if you use sort of real time as a standard. So it's many, many hours or even days, depending upon the detail of data that you want to demand from the surface. It's a very powerful technique and it has very high resolution, and you can get a lot of information, but it's not fast. And so really, it's hard to see how to use three-dimensional methods in an access kind of approach. But as a preservation tool, where you're doing a prioritized set of measurements, I think there's still a rationale for this, and I would argue that. So, all right, so here's some examples now, once you've gotten these images, about how you would actually extract information from them. So you've seen this picture a few times now. This little red line is supposed to indicate the region of this little graph. So what this graph is showing is the intensity across this line, and you can see that here's that little groove bottom, so there's a spike there, and then over here when it's crossing the surface is another spike and so forth. Once the computer can get itself around data like this, it can ask questions like, well, where are these features in the image? And it can mathematically extract, and here's what the computer did. It actually decided where the groove was on a whole series of points along here. And when you talk about sampling an audio waveform, and we say 96 kilohertz, 44.1 kilohertz, whatever, the data that you see here is being sampled at over 100 kilohertz, if I think of this as the time direction. Now, one of the And okay, this is the two-dimensional case. I could do similar diagrams when we draw the three-dimensional case, but there are methods of extracting similar information about the depths of the grooves in the case of a vertical modulation. But this is sort of just one example. So now once you've done this, obviously, well, how do I relate all this data that the computer is extracting from these images to sound? So you have to, you know, ask the question, well, what's the relationship between this physical item, this groove that we're measuring, and the actual sound that we're eventually going to hear? So in the case of electrical recordings, you know, there's a magnetic process at play. And so here's the stylus with the moving magnet and the coil. So the physical mechanism, I think you probably most of you know this, obviously, is induction. And so it's really the movement of the magnet, not its position relative to the coil, that determines the sound. And so the sound that we're eventually going to hear is proportional to the velocity of the stylus, not the stylus's displacement as it goes around. And that gives rise to the so-called, you know, constant velocity condition that people are familiar with. And so if this is a simple cartoon of a groove and it's just wiggling back and forth, the sound's not going to be loudest at the maximum of the groove. It's going to be loudest when the groove's slope is at its maximum, because that's when the needle is going to be moving fastest. And so when we look at the groove digitally, we have to take that into account. We have to actually model the stylus's motion, not its position as a function of time. Now, in the case of the acoustic pre-electrical recordings, you have to ask the same question. So there, of course, you had a different set of tools. You had the horn, the diaphragm, the linkages, and the styli. So you have to ask the question, does the stylus displacement or the stylus velocity relate to the sound once again? So if you actually think it through, the diaphragm, which is kind of the key to the whole acoustic process, is an example of a harmonic oscillator, just like a pendulum or a drum head, anything that vibrates when stimulated. The only way it could work well as a sound recording or transduction implement is if it has a pretty flat response across all the frequencies that you're interested in. If it has a resonance at 440, it's not going to work very well in this application. So the way you get a harmonic oscillator to have a very flat response over broad frequencies is to very heavily overdamp it, so it doesn't sit there oscillating every time you hit it. And so when you analyze the sort of physics of the overdamped oscillator, what you find is that in the range of heavily overdamped, it's the velocity of the oscillator that follows the driving force, not its position. And so for completely different reasons, in an acoustic recording, the sound and the stylus velocity are related to each other, just like in the case of the electrical recording. And this picture kind of breaks down at around a few thousand hertz when the mass of the diaphragm becomes sufficiently sort of problematic to break you out of this realm of function. And that's the origin of sort of the high cutoff in acoustic recordings. So now I'm going to kind of get into the actual stuff that we've done. So to make a comparison, what we're proposing to do here by using these optical methods is obviously very data intensive. You have to measure huge amounts of stuff. Maybe it's not really fast enough to do what you guys want to do, particularly in the 3D case, so that's an issue. Obviously, it has to have sufficient fidelity to somehow be meaningful. And of course, there are powerful restoration methods that the audio field is already using. So, you know, we're bringing in the non-contact element, but it has to you know, meet some standard that's already been set by what you guys can do. So on the good side, right, it's non-contact. It's potentially quite robust. It doesn't really care what the material is. The effects of damage and debris could, in principle, be reduced by this image processing scheme. You could play a broken sample potentially. You can resolve the noise sources as the scratches and dust lumps where they originate as kind of objects in an image, rather than treating them as sort of random spikes in an audio waveform. It's never going to skip. The skip is just going to be another part of the image. The groove geometry in a recording, be it a cylinder or a disc, has a very well-defined character. And so we can actually use that information, the knowledge of the groove shape, as a tool for discriminating real data and scratches and noise, because it's something that you can really compare to. The classic distortions like wow and so forth, they're pretty basically absent, or you can resolve them as kind of overall geometrical corrections to the data. And you know, if you could make this into an expert system, you could reduce the amount of operator intervention that would be required, and that kind of points towards mass digitization. So back a couple of years ago, we got interested in this problem, and we did some kind of work in our spare time on it. And I've described this work in a number of other talks, and I'm not going to go through the kind of early stuff and how we did it, because we've kind of abandoned those methods as being too slow and cumbersome. But they basically showed us that potentially this could work, and they kind of gave us an entree into your world and into your community, which was very well received, and I'm very grateful for that, and kind of got the Library of Congress interested and so forth. So I'll just play you, you know, the comparison that kind of a few years ago that kind of got us started on this. So this was Goodnight Irene of 1950, the Weaver's version, and here was what it sounded like off a disc, which I picked up at Down Home Music Shop on San Pablo Avenue, and I see Chris is here, so I have to mention that. Anyway, so here's the mechanical, you know, playback of that disc. Okay, so the familiar crackles and so forth. Okay. So we optically scanned this thing. We applied some of these processing methods to it to, you know, recognize the scratches and the debris, and this is what we got. Worse? Okay. Okay, so I'll just stop then. Okay. Anyway, so, I mean, you know, the fact that we could sort of scan something optically and, you know, get some sound off it and apply some kind of rudimentary filtering methods to it, that, you know, looked interesting, and it you know, perked the interest of Library of Congress and other entities. And so that kind of got us going to sort of see if we could do better. And so what this eventually grew into was a series of projects. One project, which became called Irene, it was to basically take this and see if it could be done as a fast, kind of efficient scanning method. And this actually turned into a project that's sort of partway completed now. It was ended up being funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities to actually build a kind of fast scanning machine for the library. And I'll tell you how that's going in a moment. And then the other thing was, you know, the library was very interested in the 3D stuff. So they supported us to try and see if we could apply some of the 3D methods to, you know, bringing the sound off cylinders. Following that, the National Archives got interested as well from the point of view of the old plastic dictation belt media. And so we've done some work in that. So for the remainder of my time, I'll sort of tell you about what we're doing with these various projects. So Irene, you laughed at the name, but you'll laugh again when you read the acronym. Right? We thought, well, we didn't exactly know what it would do, so we called it etcetera. anyway, so it was supposed to be a kind of workstation, right? And we thought it would take about a year to develop and build, and it would then go to the Library of Congress, and then they would test it. We projected that it would scan in sort of 10 minutes or 15 minutes. You know, a 3-minute disk. It would have some kind of a user-friendly interface. It would try to be efficient and, you know, make a diverse set of kind of disk media accessible. It would provide a lot of statistical information about the media condition. And it would be a kind of test bed for future development of a kind of production sort of version of the technology. So after we build the thing, and it's supposed to go to the library this year, then it's supposed to be tested. And on some kind of significant and particular sample of media, and then the library is going to document and disseminate somehow the results of all of that. And then, of course, it could grow into some sort of an upgrade or, you know, expand this media that we might study with it. There's an advisory panel of, you know, generous people that have given some time and effort to help guide it, both people from sort of the audio or technical scientific processing side of the world, some of whom are in this room, Adrian, and also from the kind of community of people that represent the collections and the archives, and so forth. So we very appreciate the help these folks have given us. One of the things we did right at the outset is the library gave us a sample of media that we tried to just image to kind of see what the quality of the images that we could get on a broad range of media were. And so there's this familiar picture on a bunch of different discs. And what we found was that about 65% of what we could look at sort of, we thought, had really good images from the point of view of extracting the information. About 25% had what we considered fair images. There were some kind of mitigating structures that would represent, you know, more difficulty in dealing with them, trying to get the information off. And then about 10% of them just looked so bad that we thought we would never be able to really get anything useful off them by this approach. Typically, the lacquer recordings, if they weren't didn't have the exudation, result in very crisp kind of images. The way the machine works is it uses what's called a line scan camera. So your little CCD camera that you all have, that has a rectangular array of pixels. But if you array the pixels in a long line instead of an array, that's really useful for scanning things that kind of fly by, like barcodes or certain kinds of labels. So what we did is we set a line scan camera along a radial line, and then you rotate the disk underneath it. And so what it does is it just takes that part of the disk, which is imaged, and unwinds it into a long stripe. And this is not the whole way around, but if it was, then this one would join, you know, the bottom of the next one, which would join the top of the next one if you connected them together. It's a really good imaging strategy for something that's going to rotate. And the maximum sampling that you can attain, given the power of the cameras and the optics that seem to be available, is almost 400 kilohertz if you want that much sampling. In practice, you don't need to sample at that rate. So here's a picture of the Irene actually in the lab at Berkeley under construction and test. Here is what we thought it would look like in the proposal, so I don't think we were that far off. It's a vibration-isolated kind of optical table. There's a computer that controls it, cameras, support structures, motion control hardware, and so forth. I think you'll agree it looks like it's in a lab. There's all sorts of stuff around it. All this stuff in the back is actually a robot which is being built to sort fruit flies based on gender. Okay. And no, it's really true. It's really important for genetics research. But it goes and it images these little, puts them to sleep and images them, and it puts them in different bottles if they're male or female. And if it can't tell, it puts them in a third bottle and then they're killed. And so that's, I think, maybe a cautionary tale for, you know. Right. So, you know, you don't want to be ambiguous about your gender, I guess. So. Anyway, but, you know, the engineering people who were working on this with us, you know, do a lot of automation, robotics, and optical stuff for, you know, all different sorts of scientific applications, and that's why the fruit fly sorter is there. So, but we'll clean this thing before it gets shipped to Washington. Yeah. Anyway, here's a little cartoon of it. You know, here's the scanner. There's the image. It's extracting the data from the image, turning it into sound. I don't know how well you can see this, not very well, but here's kind of a very short, you know, tens of milliseconds of sound extracted with a stylus and extracted with the machine, showing a very, very clear correspondence point by point and also in the frequency spectra. I don't know if this movie is going to run here on this machine, but I can try it. Oh, yeah. Oops. Okay. So this is a cellulose nitrate disc, which is rotating.
Sorry?
Yeah. And then you're going to see the images, you know, that are streaming by as they're being acquired by the system. All right, good. Okay, now one of the problems with these disks is that they're warped, as you well know. And to do really good optics, if you want really high resolution, you have to have a very small depth of focus. So we need to track that very accurately in order to keep the optics in focus. So we kind of devised an autofocusing system that bounces a subsidiary spot of laser light off the surface and then uses that to calculate the surface height. And then the output of that thing drives a motor which moves the camera up and down as it tracks along the surface. And there's a little plot. I don't know, let's see if this one works. I'm going to stick a piece of broken record underneath, and you'll see the camera just move away in response to the the change in thickness. You see that? Okay. Okay. So, and here's sort of, you know, a summary image of one revolution taken of, it covers, I don't know, a dozen or 15 tracks around the disk in one swath, and then we repeat the measurement over and over again. There's a little secondary camera that can photograph the label, and so that can actually create a record that would go with it. And the reason why this thing isn't straight is because the record is never centered, as you know. It has some off-center, lack of some extrinsicity. So engineers came up with a great scheme where we spin it once and we measure that eccentricity, and then we back the disk, which can actually move, into these little posts that will set it right at the right center point to spin it the second time. And so that's a way of kind of making the data taking more efficient. So the status of this thing is that the hardware has been configured, and we can take scans and make measurements. The main sort of control data logging and analysis code is configured and runs, and we use it quite a lot in a kind of testing mode. The scan speed targets that we set seem reasonable based on what we've been able to get the machine to do. The main issues that we've struggled with have been illumination, getting the right light sources to make this thing work properly, and getting big fields of view, so we have to take as few measurements as possible. So we can, at this point, we can process most of the scans that we take, and we can extract sound from them. The frequency that we can cover in terms of the audio content seems to be quite okay, but the restoration, the filtering aspects, the sound quality stuff, that's still very much under development. Now, so it takes a few seconds when we run this machine to measure a second worth of sound, so maybe 3 seconds per second. On that, when I played the sort of Goodnight Irene clips on our study that we did a couple years ago, it took an hour for us to measure 1 second. So with this machine, we've increased the speed by hundreds, factors of hundreds, to get to this point. And when you do that, you have to ask, well, what about the sound? So I know Chris won't like this, but here's what the stylus sounds like. Now this is everyone's favorite song. You can see now, I think, a little more clearly the waveform correspondence and sort of the lack of sharp features, which are the little scratches and so here's the optical tests, test runs that were done at the higher scanning speed. That had the same sort of curve imposed on it as the stylus version had. If you just play it back completely flat, you get this. Okay. Anyway, here's some data that was taken on much older sort of acoustic recordings that were very worn. So here's one thing, which is When You and I Were Young, Maggie, just a very short clip played with a stylus. And then again, a test scan with the optical device. Okay, and then here is, here's actually that disc that had the image quality that we judged in that sort of 10% too poor to play, you know, version. We just said, well, let's try it now that we have the machine. So here's the stylus version. Okay, and then here's the, it's quite similar actually, but we were actually able to get sound off it, which we wouldn't have predicted as being possible originally based on the images. Okay. Anyway, and then sort of finally on this, we looked at a bunch of acetates, and these are things that people brought to us that they didn't want played. So actually don't know what they would sound like if we played them with a needle, but they were kind of interesting enough that I'll share them with you. This was a recording from the 30s of a radio piece with Howard Hughes in it.
The National Broadcasting Company presents Mr. Thomas H. Beck, president of the Kroll Collier Publishing Company, who in turn will introduce Mr. Howard Hughes, announced today as winner of the Collier Trophy, the highest award in American aviation.
I want to thank you, Mr. Beck, and the Collier Trophy Committee for this very high honor. However, in reality, I'm accepting it in behalf of the many others to whom it is truly awarded. This trophy has not been given previously.
Anyway, that's Howard Hughes in a gracious state of mind. Okay, anyway, and then this was actually also quite interesting. Theos Bernard, I don't know if any of you guys know who he was, but he was one of the first Westerners to reach Lhasa in the 1920s, and was very instrumental in kind of bringing Buddhism and interest in Eastern religions and yoga to the West. And he was brutally murdered in a tribal attack in the 1940s, and his body was, I don't think, ever found, but all his, you know, porters were beheaded or whatever. But there's been a resurgence in interest in him, and people at the Anthropology Museum at Berkeley had some recordings that were discovered after being lost for 60 years or something. And so this is actually Theos Bernard himself talking.
The golden image of the coming Buddha, who is to bring the teachings to the Western world with the immortal inscription of the sacred formula, Om Mani Padme Hum, born of the lotus, inscribed in the ancient and modern lettering, taken from the religious language of India, the Sanskrit. Its entire meaning is symbolized in this mystic symbol. They believe that the mere repetition
anyway,
of...
he goes on. So, now, finally, I'll talk just a bit about the 3D scanning, and then I'll take some questions if you guys have. So, obviously, for aluminum foil, wax recordings, cylinders of vertical modulation, dictation belts, which have very poorly defined groove geometries, and problematic shellac or other discs, you need to do the full 3D scanning. Okay? Now, that's a much more time-consuming process, but in principle gives you a lot more information. And so to do that, we configured a confocal probe, the device that I described earlier, as a scanner. So here's a cylinder, and the device can move along the axis of the cylinder, and then the cylinder can rotate, and it takes series of data shots across the grooves. And you can see here it's mapping out the profile of the groove, and it's the depth that tells you what the sound is. And so this groove bottom would join with the next one, would join with the next one, and then it would come around again and again. Here's a kind of a viewer that we built that allows us to actually look at all this data kind of spilled out, you know, unwrapped onto the table. And so you can see very clearly as it sort of disappears off into the horizon, the valley structure of the media. And here's a little view across a little cut through it. This is another view of all of this. We put this, we reassemble this data together into a kind of full map of the surface. And when David was talking earlier today, he was talking about the thumps that you hear at low frequency when you play a cylinder. So this is a picture of the cylinder data kind of unwrapped. So this is the distance, if you like, from the probe to the surface of the cylinder. This is the angle from 0 to 360 around the axis of the cylinder, and this is the length along the cylinder. Okay? So if you cut the cylinder and opened it up, you sort of would have this. If this, these little little things over here that look like ridge, ruffles have ridges, those are the tracks. Okay? And these big lumps and bumps that you see, that's the gross deformation of the cylinder, the fact that it's not centered, that it has a crease in it. And these are the structures that are going to give it the low-frequency rumbly and thumpy sounds that were described this morning. So what's kind of neat about an approach like this is that we're not treating the cylinder differentially, whereas we're not taking a stylus and just, we don't know anything about the global structure, we're just going along the edge. We're looking at the entire cylinder at the same time that we can look at very specific spots. And so you can actually account for these overall deformations at the same time that you're measuring the sound. And you can correct for them in a global way rather than sort of filtering them afterwards. So here's a sound comparison that was done on like this when Sam gave his talk. I think this was the number 12 most popular cylinder on that list of hits. So here's the stylus version of the Holy City, which is which was an Edison Blue Amberol. Okay, so I think you got the picture. Now, here's what happens if you sort of play it optically. Now, you'll remember when we were talking about the harmonic oscillator and the constant velocity condition and all of that, you know, I remarked about the response curve of diaphragms and how they drop off at 5 kilohertz. Well, another interesting thing about acoustic recordings is that the acoustical properties of the horns are quite different. So the conical horn cuts off much sooner at low frequency than an exponential horn, which will actually extend its frequency response out to lower frequencies. I don't know how ubiquitous the conical horn was, but I noted that in this picture of the Edison, of an Edison recording session, they were all gathered around a conical horn. I think the physics of these horns and the ability to calculate curves like this didn't really happen until about 1920. So everything they knew about the horns they would use, I think, was fairly empirical. So with that in mind, I mean, we thought it would be fun to sort of try and compensate for this low frequency cutoff with an equalization curve, which we then apply to this optical thing. We also applied a commercial dehiss filter to it. You know, so this is sort of what if you throw things at the sound. So if you remember, I'll just quickly play again. This is what it sounded like sort of raw optically. And then if you add these enhancements to it, anyway, so damaged cylinders obviously are a very interesting area, and we thought, you know, commercial Blue Amberols, you got reasonably satisfactory results. But of course, the wax cylinders typically are earlier, some of them are field work or dictation, and they also suffer from fungus growth, and so the library was very interested in us looking at them. Here's sort of images of the surfaces of moldy cylinders and not moldy cylinders, and you can see obviously a lot more roughness in the surface, which is going to translate into degraded sound. Kind of by coincidence, we came into contact with a number of people connected with the Jack London State Park in California and the Jack London Foundation. Turned out there was a trove of cylinders that came from the park, and they were wax cylinders that were used in a dictation apparatus that London was known to use. But they had never played them or felt like they could play them. And so we actually have spent some effort looking at these. This big white swath is the mold damage, and you can see in this image how rough the surface is in it. So, you know, don't expect the sound to be very good under any circumstances in this case. But we did actually extract some sound from this one, which was in really bad shape. It's a woman's voice, which we presume is Charmian London, who is Jack London's wife. You can try and follow along. It's not going to be easy, but you can actually make out some of the words that she's saying. Anyway, there are other cylinders in that collection, and that's something that we're looking at, and obviously it would be very nice to be able to play Jack London's voice for you guys, or for anybody. So, final thing with the 3D scanning is looking at the dictation belts. I don't know how much you guys have followed the conspiracy theories of the Kennedy assassination, but there is a famous dictation belt at the National Archives, which is broken and cracked, that recorded the police microphone at the time the president was killed, and so some people think you might hear gunshots on it, other people don't. But here's what the groove looks like as we measured it with the confocal scanner. We configured it to scan a dictation belt. It's very, very poorly defined. But, you know, it's something that you can measure, and for the archives, we've been doing scanning tests and analyses on test belts, basically, and we can extract sound from dictation belts,
that Mr. William Larson preferred to turn this entire matter over to Mr. Larry Benton and Mr. Elmer Laco for a settlement with instructions not to buy the lumber under any circumstances.
So it's some legal testimony or
something. That was to pay for the invoice, and not to take the...
Anyway, so I'm going to end now, basically, just to say, well, you know, where is this all going? So obviously we're planning to complete and deliver this machine. We call Irene to the library in the near future, and they'll then undergo some, you know, testing program there. The dictation belt is something which is still under study, and that will be completed in the near future. We'll continue to look at soft wax cylinders and understand what the potential of the 3D scanning there. Another thing we're very much interested in following is doing 3D studies on lateral media themselves, which we're, you know, spent so much time doing the 2D kind of measurements on. If we were to make another, you know, big step in this effort, it would be to build a sort of 3D scanning station like the 2D station. So kind of user-oriented machine like the Irene. Of course, it's going to be slow. So it's really going to be only meaningful as either a preservation tool or as something for, you know, special projects. So it's not really going to be a mass digitization platform, obviously. So, you know, to do this, whatever we do is really going to need to be validated against real preservation standards to justify it, the effort and the expense. Of course, we're quite open to new methods that might be faster, and we think about that quite a lot. You know, what would be faster methods of scanning in three dimensions? So there's a number of people that I want to acknowledge and collaborators, Vitaly Fadeyev at Berkeley, Earl Cornell, Bob Nordmeyer. People have been involved in major way in various aspects of this work. The Library of Congress has been, you know, really important sponsor and collaborator, and the people that we deal with most closely there are Peter Allier, Larry Applebaum, and Diane Van der Ryden at Preservation, Elmer Usman and Jean Deanna. Mark Russo was at the library, is now at Pepperdine. We've collaborated with these folks in the UK and at Fribourg in Switzerland. Mitch Golden in New York, and Sam Berlofsky, particularly when he was at the library, really was quite engaged with us. The support for this work has come from the library, the NEH, the archives. the Mellon Foundation and the Guggenheim Foundation and a number of companies that have donated equipment and advice and help, we really are grateful. And a lot of advice and encouragement from our members like Adrian, Sam, Bill Klinger, Steve Smolian, Nick Berg, and others. I'm sorry if I forgot their names. So we hope that that this can grow into a tool which will help facilitate preservation and access to recorded sound history, you know, and span the range of media of the belts, the discs, the cylinders of various forms. This is the website of the project. It's not a great website, but I tend to put up recent results and copies of presentations. There are two papers that have been published in the Journal of the Audio Engineering Society last year and the year or so before, which describe, you know, the work in a very quantitatively. So, you know, and I think you can find the references at the website to those papers. Okay, thank you very much. You mean a photograph that somebody happened to take?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, so, I mean, if you were to just take a photograph of a record, the resolution would not be sufficient to do this. In fact, there was a person who did a study where they put a phonograph record on a desktop scanner. This is up on the web. And just scanned it. Okay, and so there, you know, basically the lines per inch or the dots per inch that you have, what is it? What can you get on a desktop scanner? You know, 1,000 lines or something. That's much higher resolution than you're going to get by just taking a photograph. That was really insufficient. Okay, we're having to go to micron scale, which is, you know, 25,000, over 25,000 effective dots per inch, if you like, or lines per inch. So I think not. Yeah, I think the answer would be no. So in the back. No. We received a kind of a modern tinfoil recording that an individual made for us, but we have not, I've not had the chance to actually try to scan it. Sorry.
How much work have you spent on the software to recreate the sound? Is that an area where you have a lot of
I would say, well, when you say the software to recreate the sound, you mean once we've extracted features from the image, or I mean, we're not trying to do audio signal processing. I mean, there's a world of people that know far more about that than we do. So once you get to the waveform, we would sort of leave that to the existing technology. So what we're trying to do is to go from the measured points to a waveform. And in the process of measuring the points, you affect the sound. It depends on the strategy used to measure them. So there's a lot of work going on in that area right now as we're trying to make it more efficient and deal with the actual sound quality issues. So yes, there's certainly a lot of room still for work in that area. Please. Okay, so the first move towards a kind of a more general demonstration would be the IRENE, the two-dimensional scanning system. And that's supposed to basically go to the library about this time and then be evaluated over the next year. In practice, it'll go, you know, sometime in the near future. So they will study it until, say, early 2007, you know, and you know, reach some conclusion on how well it works. We, you know, we're not in the commercialization or any of that end of it. You know, whether it becomes available as a more as a widely used tool or something, that's really going to be more, I think, the library or some other interested party's call. I don't think, I mean, I think it's too early to say, right? We were trying to be systematic about it and, yeah, and build a machine and then let the library really look at a, you know, I think this thing, it got its legs on a certain amount of, you know, potential that was, that people thought it had. And, but, you know, we realized that to really convince a community, they have to look at hundreds of disks under controlled situations, do really quantitative comparisons with, against audio standards, and then, you know, really, you know, that's why I'm even a little hesitant to even play samples, but I feel, you know, it enriches the presentation and gives people a flavor for what's going on. But I think, a year from now, hopefully the library will have, you know, a well-documented study that, that says, you know, this was a waste of money or this was a good thing to do. Right, so I mean, as you know, the sound that's stored in the groove profile is terribly redundant, right? It's encoded in the entire groove profile, the same thing, ideally. When the stylus is in there, it touches at two points, and then it uses those two points to push it, to be pushed around. When we talk about the 3D scanning, and I'll bring that picture back, what we're doing there, well, there's no picture anymore. When we talk about 3D scanning, we're measuring the groove at a whole series of points. So we can, in principle, characterize the groove with a dozen points or two dozen points, and then sort of mathematically fit a shape to that. And so, in principle, you can extract more information than a stylus could. You have to worry that, you know, you're not introducing other systematic effects because you've got motion control and optics and other things. But in principle, there's a lot of information in there because the groove is cut by something that cuts the entire profile, but it's only reproduced in the normal method by something that touches it in basically two spots. So yes, there's a lot of information. Other questions?
We're gonna have to cut it off there. Okay. All right. But okay. Thank you so much.